We're talking about offshore money, secret banking systems that exist in the world, how they're used by governments, how they're exploited even by the intelligence communities, how there's a dotted line in the rules. It's not like they say, oh, over here, everybody over here gets prosecuted, everybody over there, you're safe. They kind of cut that around depending on how they want it to be used, and that's what we're talking about, how money gets used internationally, funneling it through a system like the these underground banking systems, or even in the case of Castro's system, fairly out in the open. So that's where we'll pick up with Robert Landori coming up next. He was, when we last left him, arrested by Castro's Cuba for on charges of espionage, for basically going down there and doing business with permission on rare books. So what happened next and where does that all lead? We'll get to that coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Robert Landori was telling us one of his many personal stories that end up informing his novel, most recent one being Havana Harvest. So you're in Cuba and you're doing legitimate work through your international connections on securing rare books. And what happens? Robert? Robert? Okay. It looks like we lost him there at the last second. You know, it's interesting. I get links all the time. People send me, say, look into this story. And I just want to point out one that somebody had emailed to me that they were a little behind the curve on. We were talking about Hamid Karzai, and that was last hour, and his corruption, his corrupt government and his personal corruption, that he worships CIA money. He's really, it seems like he's a very dirty politician at the top. His brother was being used as kind of a shill for some of the money that was being transported around, and that even one of his aides was arrested and was being investigated for being a corrupt official, and yet somehow Karzai stays in power because, well, he suits our purposes. I think someday we're going to find out just how dirty Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan really was. He's going to be another Ferdinand Marcos or, you know, another Saddam Hussein or another one of these many leaders which present themselves as a man of the people, but really, came right down to it, was really only interested in what he was getting out of it and was being and was in that kind of an open arrangement with the CIA or with the U.S. government to achieve it. So we look at Karzai, and somebody sent me the link that said, did you know that he had converted to Christianity? And that maybe some of this is a backlash for him converting to Christianity. Well, I had heard this story and I just wanted to double check it. I knew it wasn't true kind of when I heard it, because it was just, it's seemingly impossible for somebody who's already in the, you know, at the end of a rifle scope with the Taliban, that he would tweak them so much by then dropping Islam and converting to Christianity. The story isn't true. It never was true. It still showed up nonetheless on a lot of blogs, and a lot of people were talking about it as though it were true. And like a lot of rumors, there were alleged sources for this. And I think it's fair to point out that if you'd heard that story, then know that it really all started with a website in England that was having did an intentional job of trying to destabilize Afghanistan by starting that rumor and trying to create, you know, Islamic backlash to Karzai, like there wasn't enough already in Afghanistan. But it never was true. However, lots of things we hear about in the news is only the tip of the iceberg of how true it is. And that brings us back to Robert Landori. So, Robert, you back then?
Yeah, I believe that I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. So when
you were asking me what happened after I got arrested and why I got arrested, right?
Right.
I did business, as I told you, with various agencies of the Cuban government. And one day an engineer came to see me, an electronics engineer, and said, look, we're building some computers and we need some parts. And could you supply them? And I said, yes, what do you need? And they told me in general terms. And then he wanted me to quote prices. And I asked him how many units he was thinking of buying. You know, is it 100, 1,000, a million, a gazillion? And this question that I asked was the basis of the charge against me for espionage, because they deemed that the question and answer to this particular question was something that would threaten the state's security. And I found this out, you know when?
No.
Approximately 6 months ago. And I was arrested in 1968.
How about that? You finally just found out about it. First of all, did they beat you up? I mean, did they throw you into a basement cell somewhere? What was it like?
Well, first of all, they didn't beat me up. Secondly, they put me in a very clean cell, but I was in semi-darkness most of the time. And, you know, the food wasn't exactly good. I went in at 185 pounds. I came out at 134. So it's a good diet to follow. Didn't have to pay for it.
And I'm sure you've kept it off since then, too. So.
Well, no, I didn't. Put it back on again.
No, you put it back on again? Okay.
But, so, you know, the food was lousy. But then, of course, Cuban food is always lousy because they don't have any food.
Right.
The conditions are terrible. The thing that was bad, you know, was the uncertainty and the isolation and being totally cut off from the world.
So how did it get resolved then? I mean, what was the catalyst to resolve it then? Was your government, was Canada begging for your release? I mean, what was happening?
Okay, Canada wrote 102 diplomatic notes to the Cuban government asking for the government to let me go. And one day, the officer who was doing the questioning came into my cell and said, pack up your bags and let's go. And I said, what bags? I had a toothbrush, some toothpaste, and a pair of pajamas. It's overalls that I had on. They gave me back my clothes and they let me go, and I was out of there.
And so you were free. That's all you know. And did you ever end up having better relations with Castro or the government?
Well, we had a deal. The deal was as follows. Don't come back. But, you know, it's an amazing thing. This experience taught me a lot of things. One of the things was, obviously, what it is like to be in fear of your life. Number one. Number two, how resilient you must be in order to survive this. And number three, what the emotions are of a man who fears that he may be condemned to death. And I used all this in Havana Harvest when I described the plight of the hero of this particular novel, because I put him in prison too, and I try to make the reader understand what it must be like to be in isolation, you know?
Yeah.
By the way, Havana Harvest, if you go to www.havanaharvest.com, you'll get more information about the book. It's a good book. At least that's what the critics say.
I'm sure you're right. I read one chapter just to double check to make sure you could write, and you can write. So I'm sure the rest of it's good. I look forward to reading it.
Thank God for the spell checker.
Yeah. Well, you got too many languages to keep track of, right? I mean, you can't be held up to that standard for every language. And your English is obviously very good. So who is the biggest user of the money laundering system? In when money is laundered through these secret accounts or these secret banks, who is it most likely who's behind it?
Well, the drug cartels, number one, terrorists, number two. These are the two very biggies, right?
Right.
And when I say the very biggies, they are it.
How much money?
I'm going to tell you, and you're not going to believe me. There is a thing called the Landori's rule. Mm-hmm. I want you to know that there are... No, I'm going to ask you a question. How many financial transactions do you think take place in a day in the world? A financial transaction is you pay your cab. That's a You know, that's
Right.
a transaction. You
Right.
pay a bill at the restaurant, that's another transaction. You pay an electricity bill, that's a third transaction. How many do you think there are in one day?
I mean,
Give me a number.
there would have to
Huh?
be trillions.
That's right. 13 trillion.
Okay, 13 trillion transactions a day.
A day. And
Wow.
this is roughly the same amount of money that is circulating in these secrecy jurisdictions. 13 trillion bones. That's a
Wow.
lot of money.
Yeah, it sure is. And so, but of that money, as you said earlier, a lot of it is legitimate. So what
No,
percentage?
this is just the illegitimate one.
Oh, that's just the illegitimate kind. Okay. So of the in the secret banking, how much then total, including the, you know, the General Motors and the other corporations that use this as a tax haven, how much money are we talking about in
I haven't got
these?
A clue.
Really? Wow.
No, I don't. Because,
so,
you know, it's not secret. Nobody gives a damn.
Sure, sure, sure. Okay, but then the 13 trillion that you say the majority of that is from drug cartels and from terrorist organizations.
Right. And also, you know, from individual people around the world who are shifting their money out. Look, Argentina was a very troubled spot, right, politically.
Right.
A lot of Argentine people with lots of money moved their money out of there into Panama because they want, and into the United States. That's offshore money for the Argentinians, right? They go and put
True.
Their money in Miami banks. That's
Right.
offshore money.
True.
Right? For them. I mean, believe me, there was a flight of capital from there. There's tremendous flight of capital from Venezuela with my best friend, Mr. Chavez, there.
Your best
you know
friend. Well, I know what I read about him in the news. Why would you call him your best friend?
I'm being cynical.
Well, I know, but I mean, like, do you...
Very critical of Mr.
Okay.
Chavez.
Have you had any personal dealings with him?
No.
Okay.
But, you know, The Havana Harvest is a book about Cuba and Cubans. And for this reason, I have to go to my best market, which is Miami, Florida, right?
Right.
And this place is overrun by people from Latin America. And they talk to, and the radio shows and the television shows are full of Chavez. And it's horrifying what's going on in that particular country.
Yeah,
I mean, the crime rate has climbed out of this world. And civil liberties are being trodden down. I mean, it's a disgrace.
You know, my sister-in-law is Cuban. She was from Cuba. She came here at about 6 or 7 years old. Her parents and my family were very close, so I got to know her parents pretty well, and they didn't really speak much English, so we spent a lot of time with them at holidays and stuff, and we all had to adapt. And then my mother's second husband was from Cuba, and so again I was sort of it seems like oh and my wife's brother-in-law, one of his parents came from Cuba, so we have all these Cuban things going on in our family. And one of the things we know, a lot of people who have gone back to Cuba from time to time for a particular reason. And when my stepfather went back, he said that there were no, he said there were no cats, there were no mice, there was nothing left in Havana because everything was being eaten.
I understand that this is so. The situation is pretty desperate. In fact, Cuba is being kept alive. Or afloat. The economy is being kept afloat by the money that comes out of the United States from relatives of
Right.
people who live there.
Right. Yeah, I know that's the case of a very famous baseball player that I know here in town whose family is still there, and he sends them money, and it supports about 13 extended family members on one
small
piece
of land. I mean, you know, Fidel Castro is an absolute genius. He decided to fire 900,000 civil servants, and his brother Raul made the announcement about a month ago, and Fidel said his economic model is not working, and then he recanted a little bit, and Raul went to see Fidel and says, Raul, what am I going to do? I have to get 900,000 people, I have to let them go. Fidel says, don't worry. What they're going to do, they're going to set up little businesses. We'll change the law so that they can have a little business, you know, a place that employs four people. And you'll see that the family members who live in the United States of America and elsewhere outside will start sending money into Cuba in order to start these little businesses, so we don't have to worry. And he's right.
That's just
you
what
read
happened.
My blog about that one. Those are goodie. It's www.robertlandori.com.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me. So then, in the name of supporting capitalism and democracy, right-thinking Americans are sending money to support their relatives, thinking that they're helping them build something, but it really was just bailing Fidel out.
Right, but indirectly, of course, weakening the regime, because if you start this capitalistic movement over there, ultimately it'll triumph and there will be a free economy.
Let's hope so. And I know this is when my stepfather went back to look at the house. It wasn't even a house. It was a second story flat over a business in Havana. And it was this sort of wonderful Art Deco building where there was a business on the first floor and then a smallish apartment, but the whole second floor of this business. And he went back to it and there were four families
living
in the same apartment that had just been the one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Typical.
And it's totally run down. I mean, the whole place was about to, he
absolutely
took a picture of
right.
it. He had a before and after, and it was amazing. So the money laundering, going to go back to the drug lords and stuff. What can the governments do? What can the U.S. government do about it? What can anybody do to cut off that flow of money?
I'm going to say something that is very unpopular in with the authorities. If we would legalize drugs, that will wipe out the drug trade. Remember Prohibition? When Prohibition was alive and well, there was no liquor in the United States, and people were smuggling from Canada barrels and barrels and barrels of booze. And the bootleggers made a lot of money.
Sure.
Why did they do that? Because the demand for it was there. Let's face it, people demand drugs. I don't know why, but they do. And if we would legalize it so that it would be dispensed like liquor is dispensed, you know, only over 18 years of age and controlled by the liquor boards, et cetera, we would cut the demand for drugs. You know, if we made hippopotamus a dirty word, everybody would say hippopotamus instead of using the F word.
Right.
that's human nature.
But they wouldn't be able to say it as much if they'd been drinking. See, the F word comes out much easier when you're drunk, I think, than hippopotamus.
Yeah. Well, just pick another word.
I'm just saying. It's not a hard sell for me to think about legalizing a lot of drugs. I don't know about every drug, but certainly a lot of them. And I don't, in a way, part of me thinks if you legalized marijuana, itself, if you just did that, you might even diminish the trade in harder drugs altogether. I mean, that may be enough right there for some people, but so point taken on that. We're talking more about money laundering coming up in just a moment, because again, I want to see now, how does it happen that these both legitimate and illegitimate U.S. businesses or U.S. businessmen, or people doing business in the United States, like drug dealers, how do they, if they can money launder in a Cayman bank, if they can money launder in Panama, how do you do it? How exactly do you do it? And what will get you caught? What will get you a red flag? What will get you arrested for that? We'll get to that coming up. Remember, tomorrow night, too, Jim Mars is going to be on with George Norrie. Always fun. Uncle Jim will be talking about who is behind the recession, he believes, at whose feet is the blame laid. You'll hear it tomorrow night, and what their motives are on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about money laundering and the secret world of secret banking. Robert Landori continues this investigation coming up in just a second. We'll talk about the legitimate and illegitimate business people in the United States using these banks. If you're thinking about hiding your own money down there, think twice. What are the red flags next on Coast to Coast? We'll get to your questions for Robert Landori coming up after the top of the hour on Coast to Coast. But if somebody were thinking about starting an offshore account, if they thought, you know, they've got enough money and they want to be able to protect, maybe they're not even certain of the future of America's banks. What are the red flags? What should they be worried about when they're looking, when they're scouting for an offshore bank? And what will be some of the things they could do that would trigger interest by the U.S. government or get them in trouble with a foreign government?
You must understand that money laundering is a crime internationally recognized, and that therefore the United Nations has certain organizations which sort of prohibit and restrain. What happens now is we have an organization which exists in 39 countries that have fintrachs. These are paragovernmental organizations to which all banks have to belong that have licenses. And in these banks, all the employees must sign an agreement whereby they abide by what is known as Know Your Client rules and regulations. And every transaction that is $10,000 or over is scrutinized. And if it's suspicious, it is reported. So if you go into your bank and you tell your bank, hey, transfer $11,500 to my bank account in Grand Cayman, believe me, it'll be reported.
Okay. And even if you've paid taxes on it in this country, even if it's an open account, you're not trying to hide anything, you just want to move money from this bank to the Cayman Bank, that will get reported.
Right. Or if it does not get reported, it will at least be investigated. I'll give you an example, okay?
Yeah.
My mother was a relatively well-known painter, and when she died, I inherited some paintings. And I sold one. And I sold one of the paintings for $12,000. And I took the $12,000 and put it in my bank account. And my banker said, hey, where did you get that money from? This is not your your payroll check. I said,
wow.
Yes, that's true. And I told him, this is what it is. And he said, okay, fine. I'm sure that he wrote up a report and then filed it, but at least it was on file. It's called KYC, Know Your Client. And it's not Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Know Your Client. So in this case, then, somebody paid attention to it, but they didn't stop it.
No, they won't stop
okay.
it.
Right.
Listen, if a man is going through a divorce or a woman is going through a divorce and she's afraid that they're going to seize her assets because the husband is a mean person, right? And she
right.
wants to safeguard them, she'll take her money, $10,000 or $100,000 or $1 million, and she'll put it with Bank of America in Grand Cayman or Panama or wherever it is. Perfectly legitimate transaction. She explains it, and that's it. Goodbye. You know? But if you do it and you don't have an explanation for it, then you have trouble. So, of course, you know, the way of doing it, you have to be, in order not to be discovered, you have to be very ingenious. Cash, of course, is the thing that everybody moves, like Mr. Karzai's brother, right?
Right, yeah, in suitcases.
But that, you know, that takes some sophistication because you have to have a truck that carries it or a private airplane that carries it, et cetera, but as you know, the drug dealers have that. The Medellin cartel and the Mexican cartels have their own aircraft and ships. I write, as you know, I write thrillers, and most of them have an overtone of money laundering in them. And I describe a lot of the things that people do. Like, for example, they buy into a business that is very cash intensive, like a restaurant. And the restaurant, of course, is not doing too well, so you can place $5,000-$10,000 extra in the bank account and sort of slide it through, right?
Right.
Are you with me?
Yeah, I sure am, yeah.
But that's peanuts. I mean, this is nothing. In one of my other novels, a guy has a boat and he buys gold bullion and gold coins and he moves them down into the Caribbean and into the Bahamas, and then he deposits it. Then there are improper stock transactions that are organized in such a way that the money goes offshore. I don't know whether you're familiar with IPOs, but you know IPOs, when they come out, they come out at a fairly low price and they have a tendency
to jump. Shoot up pretty fast, yeah.
So what they do, for example, I'm just giving you examples here. An unscrupulous stockbroker tries to get an allotment of IPO stock, but he does it on an offshore account, right? And he gets the insider tip, and the operation is done in Bermuda, let's say, and the profit goes straight to the account, and nobody knows about it.
Yeah.
Am I speaking too fast?
No, I get that. I totally get that. And so in this case, for somebody like that to profit, he's not just making a profit on the IPO, which is a windfall profit, even if you have to pay taxes on it, but then the windfall is increased by not having to pay tax on the windfall, and nobody knows, right? It's all off
the books.
Nobody
knows.
What about the guy in the boat? I want to go back to the guy in the boat with the bullion. So could you do that legally? You've got money you want to put in. You put it in, you go down, you take your boat down to Panama, and then you go in and you put it in your safety deposit box. What's wrong with that?
For example, you can do that, but it's not, you paid for the gold coin, right?
Right.
You take it down there. If you then declare that you have the money in Panama, no problem. If you forget to declare it, it's still not really that much of a problem as long as you don't sell the gold coins at a profit.
Hmm.
But the profit, if you once reported it, right, is taxable.
But not in Panama.
Pardon?
But not in Panama. If you sold
not
them.
Not in Panama.
Right.
No,
so
not in Panama.
Once you sold them down there, you could just simply say, oh, I sold my Panamanian gold and my Panamanian profits stayed in my Panamanian bank.
Right. But you're supposed to report your Panamanian profits because
sure.
you have to report all your profits.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry for your listeners to listen to all these complicated things, and
what?
I want to compensate them for this. You know, if they're really onto it, they can write to me at Havana Harvest.
No, they got it. No, they understand. This is not uncomplicated. This isn't that complicated. We're good. I mean, I think you're making it very clear. I think they should still write to you at your website, and you can link up to.
Well, no, I think that if they want, I'm going to have another book coming out, and to incentivize your readers, I want to give them two free chapters if they write
okay.
to me at. At HavanaHarvest@gmail.com. Just mention Coast to Coast, of course, and their name, and then we'll send them to two chapters of the new book.
Okay.
They'll also have some of these things in it.
Well, that's good. So, I think this has been very interesting, so I don't think you have anything to hide. In fact, when we go to phones here coming up, I want to ask people to call if they've ever had an offshore bank account, if they've ever been involved in offshore banking. You might be surprised the number of people listening to us right now that have had offshore bank accounts for one reason or another, or as part of some government operation or something that was more or less illegal. They might be able to comment on it from personal experience. So we'll look for those coming up after the top of the hour on Coast to Coast. Now, Robert, you were businesses that are, you know, semi-illegal, legal, whatever, that they're all going to kind of get the same, they'll get a raised eyebrow if they start to get an offshore bank account or trying to launder money in some way. Is there any way to get away with it anymore?
Look, it's the luck of the draw. If you do it for $100, yes. If you do it for $1,000, yes. If you do it for $10,000, it's more difficult. If you're doing it for $1 million, you're likely to get caught. But even, you know, look, I have a tragic case of a woman who fell in love with a guy and they progressed from falling in love to marriage very quickly. The guy remortgaged her house in his name, and he began to spend all their savings, and all of a sudden there was no more money left. And she finds herself now a divorced woman, right? No money. And she feels that all the money was siphoned off into the Cayman Islands or some such place. I mean, you know, there are some very, very unfortunate situations such as these that are just unjust and unfair.
Right.
But, you know, these are small amounts. And I told you there's $13 trillion floating around.
Right.
And how many people do you think are in law enforcement tracing this kind of stuff? Very few.
13.
It's very difficult.
13. One per trillion. Well, no, one per trillion. One agent per trillion dollars, probably. Yeah, very low. Yeah. And probably hard to do, too. I mean, you'd have to, there's so many working parts to this, so many different countries, so many variables.
Right.
That can't be easy to work, you know, a system like that. They almost have to wait until somebody does something that really brings themselves to the attention, where they almost like half catch themselves.
You know, I told you that, you know, these bankers, all the bank employees have to report suspicious transactions.
Right.
The statistics go back to 2005 because they're behind. In Great Britain, there were 250,000 reports of suspicious transactions reported in 1 year. 250,000 transactions.
Yeah.
Suspicious.
That's and of those, how many end up even getting investigated?
Well, that's it. They you know, they work from the top down. The bigger it is, the more likely they get to be investigated.
Right. So it goes back to your lottery theory in a way, that you could get away with it if you got enough luck.
You have to be damn lucky.
Once you've got an account open, once you have the account itself, then aren't you less likely to be caught?
Well, this is interesting. The Swiss banks thought so. And, you know, they had all these accounts from the German Jews, as I told you, and not only German Jews, all Jews, right? And they had these accounts from 1934 onwards, right? And they've been on the books of the Swiss banks since then. But now, all of a sudden, they're being sold out by this German bank clerk who's giving the IRS the infernal revenue.
Right.
The names.
And so even though, they were there, they're still not safe. What about Asia? Is there a lot of this sort of stuff that happens in the Pacific Rim? And although mostly the banks we've talked about are in Europe and the Caribbean, is there a Grand Cayman equivalent in
Yes, of course there are.
In
Singapore and Hong Kong. But relatively speaking, you know, it's small beer, as we say in Britain. Small beer, it's not that significant. I think that as far as Hong Kong is concerned, it represents maybe 6% or 7% of the total bad stuff. You know?
Where would the people investing there be mostly getting their money from? Again, the drug cartels?
Where, in Asia?
Well, in Asia.
The poppy growers in Afghanistan and Pakistan, right?
Right.
And we, you know, we haven't even talked about the Hawala, which is a parallel banking system that operates without records at all.
Well, tell me about that.
Hawala?
Yeah.
That is an invention. It was either invented by the Knights of the Crusades or by the Arabs. They're fighting over the thing. They're trying to discover who's the one. But it's money transfer without money moving. It's like, it's very interesting. Do we have time to go into it?
Yeah. I'm dying to know about it.
Well, Hawala, H-A-W-A-L-A, is a parallel form of moving money. It works like this. I have a brother in Moscow. I live in Montreal, right?
Right.
And both I and my brother are wealthy people, respected in the community. Somebody comes to me in Montreal and says, Robert, I'd like to go to Moscow. And I need $10,000 there. Will you tell your brother to give me $10,000, please? And here's my $10,000. So he gives me $10,000, and I tell my brother to give him $10,000 over there, if you understand what I mean.
Yes.
So everybody's happy. I have $10,000, which I owe my brother. And the guy who goes to Moscow is happy because he gets the $10,000 from my brother there. But we have to settle, my brother and I, right?
Right.
But we don't settle right away because we know that one of these days somebody will go to him and say, here is $8,000, and please, I'm going to Montreal. So tell your brother, Robert, that to give me $8,000 over there. So the only thing that the two of them have to settle is the difference, right? The $2,000.
Right.
You follow me?
I'm trying to.
Well,
yep.
This is done. This is a hawala operation. And the hawala operation is huge. Hawalas do about $100 million a year, $100 billion, B for B. $100 billion a year, out of which about $10 billion is done through the United States of America. Totally untraceable, totally impenetrable, because it is principally by people of Pakistani and Far Eastern origin. There are 7 million Pakistanis living offshore, in other words, not in Pakistan, right?
Right.
And they send money back and forth through the hawalas all the time. Interesting question, you know? The guy, the Pakistani dishwasher in Washington, right, who goes to the hawala every week and he sends $100 to his family, right?
Right.
That goes into, I don't know, in Peshawar somewhere to the family, we presume, but we don't know whether it goes to Peshawar for the family or for a training camp for terrorists.
Right.
Yeah, what do you think?
A lot of this stuff here, now that you describe it, this was happening a lot here where I live in Minnesota, and it was happening a lot here with the Somalis.
Right? The Somalis do it big time. Yeah.
Yeah. And that this was the FBI started watching this after 9/11. They made this system illegal because of what you just said. They would go and they would say, in some limited cases, not all Somalis by any means, but some Somalis would say, I want this $1,000 to go to my cousin. Muhammad. And yeah. But cousin Muhammad was a code word for Al Qaeda. And so
for example.
And so there was no cousin Muhammad on the other end. It was all everybody knew what that code meant, and that was going to go right to yeah. They were cracking down on that left and right here in the Twin Cities because even after they made it illegal, the system was still being used.
But you know, it goes the other way too. There's money coming over from Pakistan to here that goes into the so-called madrasas, which are the religious schools attached to the mosques.
Sure.
Right. And we don't know what that is being used for.
That's true.
And we haven't touched on that, you and I, because, you know, a wallet transaction in India, which is a country of interest, ranged between $13 and $15 billion annually.
How about that? And all of it off the books.
Off the books. The total hawala-based stuff is about $100 billion a year. And out of that, about $10 billion is being done or affects the United States of America. You know how many there are 7 million Pakistanis offshore?
Right.
Out of which 1.2 million roughly are in Saudi Arabia, 1.1 million in the United Arab Republic, 1.2 million in the United States of America. And surprisingly, in my country, in Canada, there are 700,000 Pakistanis.
Well.
And so, 300,000 in Europe.
That's a lot of hawala. That's a whole lot of
hawala potential. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Big time.
Then this is where we'll leave it till we come back for phones. We'll give you all the numbers at the top of the hour on Coast to Coast. Robert Landori, the novel is Havana Harvest. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. It's an international thriller, lots of intrigue involving the moving of money, among other topics as well. And then also, have you been involved? Have you been involved in a hawala? Have you been involved in money laundering? Have you gotten caught? Did you get away with it? If you had an island, account somewhere offshore, or for that matter, a Swiss bank account next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.